right, good friends, welcome. It is 4 p.m. Central Time. You're listening to my voice on the Great GCN Radio Network, either online or through one of our Great GCN Radio affiliates out there. In either case, it means it's now time for INN World Report Radio. Welcome, friends. My name is Tom Kiley, and I'll be your host for the next 1 hour right here on GCN, where we come to you 5 days a week now, Monday through Friday in the same time spot. And we have a good show lined up for you tonight. We are going to be joined in just a few more minutes with by Doug Guthrie. He's a professor of sociology, joint appointment with the Department of Management and Organization at the Stern School of Business right here in New York City. He's a fellow New Yorker at NYU, New York University. And we're going to be talking with Doug about China. This is a subject that I've been meaning to focus on for a while now. Things are really starting to heat up as the People's Republic of China really starts to come online now and feel it's coming into its own in the modern era, I would say. Certainly China has been on its own in historical realms back when Europe was, you know, crawling around in caves and stuff. But, you know, things come and go. Civilizations come and go and wax and wane, as it were. And the Chinese civilization has been in a relative dormant state compared to the sort of empire status that it has enjoyed in the past. But it looks like it is rapidly coming back to be able to reassume those kinds of roles in the world. How does that impact the status quo? How does that impact American aspirations to empire and so forth, which have obviously been growing rapidly since the end of the Second World War, you could argue with the beginning of the Spanish-American War, perhaps, and the waning of the British Empire and so forth, and this sort of symbiosis that seems to have occurred between the United States and Britain to sort of fill the breach for them. How does that equation get altered now with China coming online, and particularly right now because the Western powers that be, centered from the United States with the economic system and so forth, seems to be in a very bad way at the moment. A lot of people would argue hasn't been this bad since the Great Depression, and so you know it's hard for the United States to point to itself in the rest of the world as some sort of a role model or a leader. And you've got other economies, notably China and now India as well, very large country coming up online right at the same time that the United States is in a poor leadership position. So that's the subject I want to focus on. Doug Guthrie is going to join us to talk about just that. Meanwhile, the phone lines are open. If you want to give me a call, 866-582-9933. You can give me a ring, 866-582-9933. Call me up. I will be happy to send you off a book. How about I'll send out a copy of The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century by James Norman, who was on with us yesterday right here in this time spot. A great book, and also, very interestingly, pretty much on the same topic that we're going to be talking about today, but from a different perspective, from a resources perspective and from an oil perspective. It turns out that at least in the current state of affairs, China is not particularly wealthy in several natural resources that its growing economy requires, most notably oil. I think bauxite is another element in short supply there. So they're heavily dependent on getting this from the outside world. As I understand it, they at this current level, they have to import about half of what they use. And, of course, it looks like the Chinese economy has an awful long way to go yet. So if that's the condition that they're in right now, it's only going to get worse. And in his book, The Oil Card, James Norman, who is a writer who's been focusing on the oil industry for a very long time, he posits that perhaps there's a deeper meaning to the crazy geopolitical stuff that's been going on, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. Mainly more to encircle China and to affect the flow of oil in the world, not necessarily like everybody thought because the United States needs so much because we apparently, between our own supplies and our very close friends, the Canadians and those in Mexico, plus the Saudis, we seem to be in fine shape. The game, or the great game, as it is often called, now seems to be revolving around limiting China's access to these resources that it requires. So that's going, in and of itself, down the road, produce some sort of tension for sure, and it already seems to be flaring now. And I say, I think it's from my reading anyway, it's because the United States is in a perceived to be in a rather weakened position right now, right when China is coming on. And after all, of course, we owe the Chinese so much money, so that does not help the situation at all. And right now, we're coming to loggerheads. There is a arms sale that is scheduled to go forward to Taiwan, and of course, this kind of thing typically really upsets the Chinese. And now, and in the past, they've gone through. In any case, now they seem to be acting in ways that they haven't in the past, protesting stronger, for instance, and really some interesting things in the paper on how that can manifest. So in any case, if you'd like to give me a call, why don't you do so, 866-582-9933, and I will be happy to send you off a copy of this book, The Oil Card. Very, very interesting. And looking at the numbers, how James Norman posits that, oil as a resource has been manipulated in the last part of the 20th century. The price was artificially held down, which, according to James, it really, really impacted the Soviet Union and was a major, major factor, I guess he would say the single largest factor, which caused that society to crumble. And now that's out of the way, the price is artificially high, even though there's a super glut of oil in the world, according to James Norman. The technology to find it has been improving every day. There is more and more oil being found that nobody knew about in the past. And the reserves that everybody has, there's a tremendous amount of oil sloshing around. So it's not that there's a shortage of oil. So the price is artificially high by speculators, and if you look at the speculators, then you begin to see a pattern emerging where actually this kind of speculation on that large of a scale can be traced back to a sort of a national security position, and it keeps the price high. So, of course, this makes the Chinese have to pay a great deal for something that they need desperately, and as I understand it also, the capability to refine the oil there in China is not so great either, so that just adds more stress to the entire system. So in any case, that's what we're going to be talking about, focusing a little bit more today, again, on China. And it is something that we need to be looking at because, all things change, right? And I think most empires just have always behaved like there's no tomorrow, like things are never going to come to an end. And certainly, as the empire game has been kept alive by these United States in the world, that means that it's only, I guess, fair for somebody else to come and say, hey, it's our turn now. So how's that going to play out? That's what we're going to be talking about with Doug Guthrie from New York University on the other side of this break. This is Tom Kiley, INN World Report Radio. We'll be right back with you just after these messages.
My name is Pez. My name is Bob. My name is Jack. Mine is the last voice that you will ever hear. Don't be alarmed.
America, you are being tested, but here's where we study for it. From 1/2 mile north of Ground Zero in New York City, you are listening to INN World Report Radio with Tom Kiley. Now, daily on GCN, 4 until 5 p.m. Central.
Thank you.
For 9 years, the alternative media activists at INN have produced national daily television news and information programming, top-of-the-hour radio news briefs, and INN World Report Radio, news talk radio that brings you real news the networks won't tell you, and all of it 100% certified neocon-free. To find out more and for details on the stories we are following, go to INNWorldReport.net.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Good friends, welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN World Report Radio, 5 days a week right here on the great GCN radio network, 4 until 5 p.m. Central Time. And as I said earlier this week, we're going to be continuing the end of the week here, focusing on China and U.S.-China relations. Clearly, China is coming into a position of strength that it hasn't seen in centuries. I would imagine back the last time it felt this way, there was not such a global set of other superpowers to deal with, and so I guess it's a new situation for the world in general. And so to do that, we've asked several people to join us, and here finishing out the week, we're being joined now by Doug Guthrie from New York University, who studies teaches sociology, in particular how it works in China. Forgive me, Doug, if I don't have all that correct, because your resume is quite deep. So in any case, welcome for the first time to INN World Report, and I'm sure we'll be talking with you about this, because this is a subject that's just going to continue to grow.
I'm happy to be here, and I look forward to the conversation.
Well, then, let's start off with my premise. China clearly is coming into a position of strength that it hasn't seen in hundreds of years. That's fair to say, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely fair to say. I mean, typically when I teach this either to undergraduate students or even to I do a fair amount of teaching to executives because I'm my primary appointment is actually in the business school at NYU. And, you know, I often try to give people a sense that, you know, there was a time in the world about, you know, 1420 in which China was far and away the dominant economy in the global system. And then there was a long period of downturn in which China turned away from global expansionism. And so now China is reemerging back into a position that many people in Chinese society think they should have been in for hundreds of years. And so I think it's an interesting moment for China, because they really believe that this is their right place in the world economy.
Yeah, that's, I get a sense of that for sure, because I know that China, I feel sometimes when we back in the West were sort of crawling around in caves, you know, they had a pretty advanced civilization. I think that the Chinese are well aware of that and are proud of that.
Yeah.
And maybe you can touch on for a moment what happened, what caused the dip between the 1400s and the last 50 years or so?
That's an interesting question, and it's a great question in terms of sort of the culture versus economics sets of issues. So in about from 1400 to 1420, the Ming Dynasty was really at the height of its powers, and there was an emperor named Yongle who was in charge of things there, and an admiral who worked as his henchman named Zheng He. And typically, you know, if you think about 1492 and Columbus was sailing the seas at that point, funded by the Spanish government with the height of maritime technology in Europe, you know, he set forth with 90 sailors across three ships, three mast ships, the height of maritime technology in Europe. And at that time, about even 70 years earlier, Zheng He was typically sailing the globe with 28,000 sailors on 300 ships, typically 400 feet ships. They used to go to Africa and bring home elephants as tributary to the emperor. And so it was a very different kind of structure. And I think the short story of what actually happened economically was that there was a cultural battle in which Chinese Confucian scholars who were high in the government decided it wasn't right for China to be involved in mercantilism. And they destroyed all maritime technology and decided it was against the law to be engaged in this kind of process. And China kind of went into a very isolationist period that, you know, 400 years later, China would be in the process of being defeated by Britain in the Opium Wars, and later Japan in the Sino-Japanese War. And so I think for China, their heyday was really in 1420. And so they really believe in kind of reclaiming that position in the globe.
That's amazing. I guess some sort of Confucian fundamentalism must have taken hold. I can say that I'm familiar with the Taoist part of Chinese philosophy and the Buddhist part, but I don't know all that much about the Confucian part. Was this was there some basis for this in Confucianism, or was this some sort of crazy fundamentalism that went wrong?
It was a little bit crazy, but I would say that there was some basis that went beyond Confucianism in that, you know, for 2,000 years, China was the center of a tributary system of nations. So China, from about 500 BC by Western calendars to about 1500 AD, was really the most dominant nation in at least in Asian terms, what was regarded as the fundamental tributary system of nations, in which all nations were subsidiary to the Chinese government, and they would come and pay homage to the king. And so they developed what some Chinese intellectual historians have called somewhat disparagingly the Middle Kingdom syndrome. You know, if you think about the Chinese character, the very characters themselves mean Middle Kingdom. And so China was very much built on a political and economic system in which China was the center of the world. And so when the Western world came to China, I mean, if you think about the comparison between China's system in Asia and, you know, the kingdoms in Western Europe, it wasn't quite the same. Like, you know, there were these competing kingdoms in France and England and the Netherlands, but they all saw themselves as sort of equal monarchies, right? But China didn't ever see itself that way. It saw itself as the center of a tributary system of nations in which it was the first among equals. And so
sounds kind of like something that Dick Cheney would wish to happen to him,
right?
Yeah? I'm
yeah,
guessing.
I mean,
yeah.
Sort of. I mean, it's an interesting point because certainly the U.S. In recent years has wanted to think of itself in that way. But, like, you can kind of – what I try to emphasize in my teaching of Chinese culture and economics is it's more interesting to talk about Chinese culture not as this sort of superficial notion of a connection-based society, but much more about what was its role in history 500 years ago and how is it confronting – competitors today. And I think, like, if you look at the U.S. role in the global economy today and China's kind of chafing under that dominance, that's actually more of, you're right, like, what Cheney thinks versus what Hu Jintao thinks, like, that's the core of it. Right?
Well, why don't we hold it right there? We're talking with Doug Guthrie from New York University about China coming back online as a superpower in the world. We'll be right back with him after this.
Work!
good friends. Welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN World Report Radio, Monday through Friday, right here on the great GCN radio network, 4 until 5 p.m. Central, where we try anyway to live up to the INN motto of bringing you real news the networks won't tell you, and information that you need that you're not getting in the corporate media. And I think in that spirit, we're having a very interesting conversation with Doug Guthrie from New York University about China reemerging to a very, very prominent position in the world. How prominent is it going to be? Well, that's what we're trying to find out, what can happen. Because, Doug, the last time China was a superpower, I guess the Europeans were quite far away. There wasn't a lot of direct interaction or certainly conflict, was there, between East and West at that point?
I mean, in the 14 and 1500s, no. But then China went very isolationist, as we talked about in the last segment, and they became very, very tied to the idea that China should really be the center of this system of tributary nations. And then during that time period, through the 1500s and 1600s and 1700s, Europe developed into mercantilism, and they became very powerful in the global system of nations. I mean, you know, this is what Europe built its economies on. And by the 1800s, Britain and the Netherlands and Spain were much different animals to deal with at that point than China thought they were 300 years earlier. And so it was a really rude awakening for them. So by the Opium Wars of 1842, it was a very different situation.
Very interesting. Right at the time China is going away from a super, mercantile position in the world with these great fleets that you referred to, Europe is coming into its own in that regard. So it's almost like a switch, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting moment for China, because China sort of decides culturally that this is beneath them and they don't want to be involved in mercantilism. I mean, mercantilism is essentially an economic system that's based on going out to other nations and culling commodities from those nations and becoming rich based on those. And China decides they don't want to do that. Europe does it and becomes very wealthy and very powerful militarily. And then, you know, I mean, the rest is history. I mean, the rest is that Europe conquers the globe and China doesn't. So it's a really interesting decision.
So now China's having a second bite at the apple, I guess.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. I think that, you know, I would hesitate to predict what they would have done with hindsight knowledge, but I think they really, you know, I think the Chinese leaders that I talk to often are very kind of clear about what their goals are, and their goals are to be the dominant economy in the world. And so they are organizing their economic and political stance in the global economy accordingly.
And I'm sure it's going to take some time, but I'm also sure that doesn't faze them. China is a very, very large country, large population, large economy. And I once complained to an uncle when he asked me, how are things going? I said, oh, things are moving at a glacial pace. He said, that's okay. You ever try to stop a glacier? Of course, that was before global warming.
Right.
This seems like an inevitable advance, right? So now that's going to have to, at some point or another, if it isn't already, come up against these same kinds of aspirations that are taken for granted, for instance, here in the United States, or have been anyway since at least the end of World War II. Isn't that correct?
Yes, although I have to say what I fear for the U.S. is that I think the Chinese technocrats are much more economically and politically savvy than we give them credit for or think they are. And I think they have a very clear vision and a very clear understanding of how they need to gradually move this, to use your analogy, to move this glacier. And they're winning. Like they, you know, we have very simplistic ideas that are kind of boiled down to sort of politics and simplistic economic ideas, and they are dealing with much bigger questions of how to move a very powerful labor force and a powerful economy in the directions that they want them to, and they are doing it very effectively.
Well, in that regard, then, where do they get the vision for this kind of movement? Is it deep in the roots of Chinese society, or is this something relatively new that was learned after the Communist Revolution, or a combination of the two? Have they picked this up from observing the mistakes of others? Where do you think they get this vision from?
So I think there are two periods that we need to look at for Chinese society to really understand where the vision comes from. The first is that Deng Xiaoping, who was, you know, the leader who was in competition with Mao and largely regarded as the father of the economic reform. So he's the person who came into power in 1979. He had a very pragmatic vision. His vision was, you know, China is on the verge of bankruptcy in 1979. We cannot be that. Like, that is not going to get us back to, like, the hallowed days of Ming supremacy. So we need to figure out what has gone wrong, and we need to be very pragmatic. He visited Carter in January of 1979. He also visited Seattle and Atlanta and NASA. And he had very clear goals in those things, and he was sending a signal to the world in which it was very much tied to the idea that, you know, Deng Xiaoping was always famous for saying, I don't care if a cat is white or black as long as it catches mice, right? So I don't care about communism or capitalism as long as we are rich as a nation, as long as we win. And his view was basically, I want China to be on top of the world, so let's figure out how to get that, and let me pragmatically help guide the world there. So he was very pragmatic in that stance, but he only kind of took the world, or took China half that direction. The next phase was the second generation of leaders in Zhu Rongji and Jiang Zemin, who took a very pragmatic but also innovative approach to building legal infrastructure and intellectual property and, you know, all of the kinds of things that would attract foreign investment. And then they became a very, very, you know, powerfully organized nation around the issues of attracting foreign direct investment and developing processes in which people would you know, view China as the factory of the world. And so it really became a juggernaut of economic development.
So you raise an interesting point. How much of China can still be called communist at this point? I mean, is it a facade? Is it just the security control over the population? Is it is there anything economic that is communist anymore in China? What do you think?
That's a great question, and I would say on the economic front, zero has to do with communism. I would say the only thing that matters for communism is the name and the face of the authoritarian government that is still in power, because they don't want to admit that communism is dead and doesn't matter anymore. But it has nothing to do with communism a la Marx.
Like, well, can I add one thing there, though, and see what your response is? I would say probably chief among the relics of communism is the one-party solid control without having any kind of political competition. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, that this is still an authoritarian government that exists.
Doug, why don't we hold on right there? We're speaking with Doug Guthrie from NYU about China coming on strong. We'll be with him right after these messages.
America, you are being tested, but here's where we study for it. From 1/2 mile north of Ground Zero in New York City, you are listening to INN World Report Radio with Tom Kiley. Now, daily on GCN, 4 until 5 p.m. Central. For 9 years, the alternative media activists at INN have produced national daily television news and information programming, top-of-the-hour radio news briefs, and INN World Report Radio. News talk radio that brings you real news the networks won't tell you, and all of it 100% certified neocon free. To find out more and for details on the stories we are following, go to innworldreport.net.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Good friends, welcome back. Coming down the home stretch, not just for today's show, but for this week as well. And I hope you'll have a great weekend. We're having a very interesting conversation. Friends, you know that I've been saying that I want to start focusing more on China and U.S.-China relations because this is something that's coming. I mean, it's been coming for quite some time, but it's getting to the point now, I think, where we're going to start to see some major changes in the way business is conducted and foreign policy is conducted. I think there have been some changes already, but they've been more subtle. And to that end, we've been joined today by Doug Guthrie from New York University. You know what happens in the last segment? I always run out of time, so let me say it now. Thank you very much for coming. This is a great conversation, and I'd like to have you back, number one. And number two, can you tell our listeners a website or something where they can go to find out more about you and what you've written and what you teach?
Sure. I appreciate being here, and I so much enjoy this kind of conversation. So thank you very much for having me. And, people can find me on the NYU and NYU Stern School of Business website. I also have a personal website at Guthrie-Associates.com. It's just where I work with a group of people who try to work through all of these issues, and we have lots of articles posted on these issues.
Well, that sounds good. I don't have to go there myself. I did see the New York University one. All right, so then I know it's a big subject. I think we'd like to have you back so we can continue to explore dimensions of it, but I'd like to, in this final segment, just take a whack at, you know, the coming changes. I guess, interestingly, China was a superpower back in the day when relative superpowers didn't have a lot of interaction with each other, vis-a-vis East and West anyway. And I think the same could be said for Europe, where China was sort of bowed out of the scene. Now we've got this superpower situation where it's just about covered the whole earth. And does that philosophy of superpowerism mean that there's going to inevitably be a conflict until there's one winner? Or do you think we might have a brighter future where everybody can say, okay, that's the way it used to be when everybody was isolated on their side of the world, but now we have to find out a better way to go forward?
So the interesting answer to that question, I think it sort of turns on its head. You know, so if people like Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and whoever else are the hawkish people were in power, they typically like to present China as this kind of, you know, expansionist power that is trying to take control of the global economy and take control of Asia. And I think the interesting thing to understand about China is that we can actually learn a lot from what China is doing in terms of its political economy position in the world. And so I think, you know, the U.S. model is like, you know, we have a lot of money, we invest a lot in military, and we control the world if we need to. And I think China's position has been much more like, we have a growing amount of money, we have some military, but we're much more about economic interdependence. And so if you look at the way that that China has dealt with the Taiwan problem, the Tibetan problem, and U.S. relations. I won't call U.S. relations a problem, but all of those have been oriented towards economic interdependence. So China is very, very oriented towards how do we create economic interdependence in ways that will make any kind of tensions, political, social, international go away. And I think they have done that effectively on every front, and it's been very interesting to watch it happen. With Taiwan in 1989, you know, 1989 was marked by a lot of foreign investment pulling out because of the Tiananmen massacre. And so China very quickly changed the rules about cross-strait relations between Taiwan and Fujian province because they wanted Taiwanese investors to reinvest that capital, but also to become invested in China. And so within a 10-year period, the issue of Taiwanese independence had kind of gone away because people very quickly understood that, you know, most of the wealthy Taiwanese businessmen were so invested in the southeastern seaboard of China that there's no way that Taiwanese independence even is an issue anymore. And they did a similar thing with respect to...
Well, I need a little clarification there. It's not an issue because it'll never happen because they've been bought off, or it's not an issue because it can stay that way and we're so economically interconnected now that it might as well be part of China proper?
I mean, it's more the latter, but also we need to note that the Western understanding of that history has been a little bit shallow, and so... You know, it is the case that, you know, Taiwan was, you know, conscripted from China by the Portuguese and also by the Japanese in the Sino-Japanese War and also by the Kuomintang. And so there's a complex history there. But I think China's position has been like, okay, how do we get both of our economic interests aligned so that nobody is interested in talking about independence, but we're interested in talking about integration? And so, you know, they did that very effectively by, you know, so when Chen Shui-bian becomes, you know, he was the head of the Democratic Progressive Party and he was elected in 2000, he kind of ran on a platform of Taiwan independence. But when he got into power, he never talked about Taiwan independence. And I suspect what happened with him is like his economic advisors took him in a back room and said, look, dude, if you declare independence, not only is it questionable whether the U.S. will support you? But the bigger issue is that 500,000 of our wealthiest businessmen have already migrated to the southeastern seaboard of China, and they will defect because they're making more money there than, you know, there's no economic incentive for us to do this, and so you need to chill out. And so I think that China's position has been, how do we create economic interdependence in a way that makes a lot of these political issues go away? And I think they've been very effective in doing this.
You know, in hindsight, I think if you look at U.S.-China relations through that lens, I bet there's been an awful lot of moderation in United States foreign policy that we just kind of – it happened so subtly, maybe we didn't realize it. But when you take a look at the way things used to be in the 50s compared to the way they are now, for instance, I think you're right. I think that that's already been taking place, a temperament. But I don't know how long that's going to last when, you know, things when push really comes to shove, because you're talking about two, I guess, very different systems, an economic interdependence versus, you know, I guess on the surface, an economic interdependence, but with one strong military component dominating things to the point where it's going to go our way eventually in any case. That's a little complicated, but I guess I'm talking about the U.S.'s reliance so heavily on the military since the end of World War II.
Right. I mean, I think that's a big issue. And I think that the main issue is that China's position, like the reason China is the biggest owner of treasury bills in the United States is that they are trying to create that kind of economic interdependence, and they have it. Whether or not we respect that and whether or not we all sort of understand that China is underwriting U.S. debt and like we're not in as big of a recession as we could be because they're buying so many of our treasury bills, I don't think that that's given kind of fair play, but I think that, that China has been very aggressive in taking that position because they really want to be a partner with the U.S. rather than a Cold War competitor.
Well, I think it's a very interesting question. We're coming down to the end of the hour here. Doug, are you available next week to continue this conversation? Because I still have a lot of points that I didn't even have a chance to get to yet.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to talk about this next week.
That'll be great. Sure. That'll be great. I will. If you'll hang on the line just for a moment here, I'll ask you a quick question about scheduling, and then we'll have Doug Friends back next week to continue this conversation. It's an important one, and I think we need to have it. And why not speak with somebody who teaches this and learns it, has learned it himself and teaches it to others. So that's we got a sort of open classroom situation. Doug, thanks. Please hold on and have a great weekend, everybody. This is Tom Kiley, INN War Report Radio, and we'll be back here with you next week, 4 p.m. Central Time, Monday through Friday, until 5 p.m. Central. So have a great weekend, friends, and we'll see you then.